We're talking about genetic genealogy used in forensics here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Genealogy sites allow you to trace your family roots and find your ancestors, and now police departments and the FBI are using them to crack cold cases and find suspects. Last month, William Earl Talbot II became the first person convicted of murder with the help of genetic genealogy. And this has really big implications for crime fighting and also privacy. Do you think genealogy sites should cooperate with law enforcement in order to track down crime suspects? Or do you think it's these companies' responsibility to protect the private genetic information of their customers? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Heather Tall Murphy is a reporter for the New York Times, and she writes about how DNA technology affects our lives. Heather, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
So how does this genetic genealogy work, and how is it different from regular DNA testing?
Yeah, so it's really quite different in the sense that genetic genealogy is an innovation in a technique that enables typically a genetic genealogist, I call them advanced puzzle masters who are skilled at solving these sort of unusual puzzles of DNA. And they take DNA and instead of uploading it to a traditional police database or the FBI's criminal database, which is full of people mostly convicted of felonies and some people arrested, they take it and they upload it to one of two genealogy databases. And they're not looking for the person. They're not looking for the suspect who matches the DNA from the crime scene the way that they've been doing for years when they've been using criminal DNA databases. Instead, what they're doing is they're looking for relatives of that person, perhaps a second cousin, maybe even a third cousin, or maybe they'll get lucky and find someone closer. From there, they're building a family tree, they're building it back, they're building it forward, they're filling it in with all kinds of things, and that is how they arrive at a hypothesis of a possible name that could be a name to that DNA. So it's a pretty different process in terms of how they arrive at putting a name to DNA.
So they're kind of reverse engineering a family ancestry genetic information. And these big databases, one is called GEDmatch. Is that right?
That is right. Yes,
and
exactly.
Family tree DNA. So how do they work? And how does this public database get created? Where did it come from?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people are calling it a public database. In fact, in this recent trial in which this technique was tested in court for the first time, both the prosecution and the defense was throwing around the term public database. I think actually some people would object to calling it a public database because these two databases are privately owned databases. They're not exactly like Wikipedia. These are not nonprofits that are, you know, that function that way, but they're public in the sense that they're easy to search. If you join 23andMe, which millions of Americans have, if you join Ancestry.com, which millions of Americans have as well, then what you know is that you make an account, it's behind your login. In order to search for relatives and upload anything, you have to go through them, you have to send them your spit, they process your spit. They do all that. It's a closed system. The difference with Family Tree DNA and GEDmatch, they're not closed systems. So they're publicly searchable in the sense that even if I years ago got my DNA tested with 23andMe and now I decide, you know what, I'm ready to see if I can find even more relatives or I wasn't satisfied what I found there. I can take that file that was analyzed with 23andMe and I can upload that file to GEDmatch or I can upload that file to Family Tree DNA. And in that way, it makes it possible for somebody who has had that file analyzed even with a private lab, maybe it was DNA that was taken from a crime scene, to upload it to those sites. And those sites have rules that have actually changed again. They keep changing in the past year as all this stuff is coming to the forefront. But those rules about how those sites can be used is different than the sites like 23andMe and Ancestry that even more of us have used.
We're talking genetic genealogy with Heather Tall Murphy. She's a reporter with the New York Times writing about how DNA technology impacts our lives. Do you think genealogy sites should cooperate with law enforcement in order to help track down crime suspects? Or do you think it's these companies' responsibility to protect the private genetic information of their customers? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Heather, earlier this summer, genetic genealogy was used in court for the first time. It led to a guilty verdict in a murder case. What happened there?
Yeah, so what happened there is we have this young Canadian couple, Jay Cook and Tanya Van Kuhlenberg. They're 20 and 18, and they were last seen alive on a ferry going to the Seattle area from Canada in 1987. And like many of the cases that have been advanced recently using genetic genealogy, there was a DNA profile. It was known simply as Individual A. And for decades, detectives could not figure out how to identify Individual A. And that was the primary lead they had, is Individual A. It was actually in this particular case, it was DNA that had been gathered from semen. There had been apparently a sexual assault on Tanya, and this is what they had. And so what happened is that in 2017, the detective started to hear, there's this other approach to putting a name to DNA beyond what he could do in the criminal DNA database. Because the criminal DNA database, again, particularly in Washington State, you upload a DNA profile. If your person is a convicted felon, then you get a match. You're not actually in Washington State permitted to do any kind of familial searching. And then he heard about this new technique. And so what happened is this case that had gone unsolved for decades, actually within the course of a single day, the genealogist, she's very skilled. This isn't to say that any of us could do this, but the genealogist uploaded to GEDmatch and did this sort of puzzle technique with the family history. She built it back to a common ancestor. She found these two second cousins. She built it forward. She found the potential parents. They had one son. The one son was about the age of the person they suspected would have killed them. It turned out the parents had lived 7 miles from one of the crime scenes. And suddenly, after all these years, they had an arrest. So that is the backstory of this case. And so what happened is that this was the first time that this technique had been tested in court, meaning that previously we've seen there's been about 50 identifications of people and we've seen people plead guilty. But a big question was for many prosecutors and detectives and genealogists is how is this going to play out in court? Because solving this case essentially relied on relatives' DNA to identify the suspect's DNA. And those relatives' DNA arguably had no idea at that point in time that their DNA would be used that way. So is this okay? And what ended up happening is there was no challenge to the technique. It soared on through. Even the defense did not choose to challenge or pick apart the technique. They treated it as just another tip system, and he was convicted.
We're talking with New York Times reporter Heather Tall Murphy. She writes about DNA technology and she stays with us. Do you think law enforcement agencies should be allowed to use DNA from genealogy websites in order to help build their cases? Have you ever used a genealogy website to explore your family history? Did you provide genetic information about yourself? What do you think about using it for purposes of crime fighting? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're at the intersection of genetic genealogy and crime fighting here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Law enforcement agencies are using genetic information uploaded to a database to help find suspects, maybe crack a cold case. Genetic genealogy is where investigators try to link crime scene data to DNA from biological relatives in the hopes of generating leads for identifying suspects. And the recent rise of online, easily accessible DNA databases is taking this to a whole new level. There are dozens of criminal cases pending, which have been built on leads generated by genetic genealogy, including a double homicide and rape case here in Wisconsin. Have you ever used a genealogy site to trace your family history? Did you provide genetic information? Do you think these DNA databases should cooperate with law enforcement? Join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. New York Times reporter Heather Tell Murphy stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Matt joining us from southeastern Minnesota. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Kate.
What's on your mind about this?
Well, I've been listening to this for a while, and I understand the good here, and I understand the need here, but what I don't understand is how it's justifiable, because this is your private data, for one, but for two, it's kind of dangerous to have all this information accessible when there's cyber terrorism, and we hear about Chinese experimenting with genome splicing and cookie cutter babies and whatnot.
So Matt finds this pretty scary. Heather, what are the implications for regulating this?
Yeah, so I think there are people who, a lot of people who do find it scary. I mean, I think one thing to clarify in terms of, you know, you mentioned genome splicing, is what people are uploading is not, you know, these sites don't actually have these people's DNA. What they have is their files that contain all this genetic information. But that is precisely also why some people do find it scary, because that information tells so much about ourselves, and we're actually still in the process of understanding what exactly that tells about ourselves. And so a great deal can be learned. You know, I think there's some people who argue, well, the internet already has so much information. But then others would say that there is something very different about all the information about us on the internet combined with this DNA that creates a whole new type of privacy matter. It's not just those of us who've actually taken a DNA test that could be identified using this technique. All that's required is one or two or probably two of people who are in the third cousin range for us have joined these sites. And then even if we have never taken a DNA test, then our saliva could be identified by law enforcement. And so, yeah, so though these are broad concerns, but there's some people say this has already happened now. So now it's a matter of thinking about what do we do about it. And at this point, it is not regulated in any capacity.
Well, let's look at those legal implications. Law enforcement already use a national DNA database, FBI database. It's called CODIS. How is that different?
Yeah, so CODIS is a highly, highly regulated database. The way it works depends somewhat on the state, but there is a lot of processes. So the types of crimes so first of all, it's mostly for convicted felons. In Wisconsin, actually, some arrestees' DNA can be uploaded to it depending on their crime. Again, that depends on states. But the way that police can search it is also highly regulated. I was actually just looking out of curiosity how it works in Wisconsin. And in Wisconsin, there, for example, police can do some searches for people's relatives. It's not the same kind of search they do on genealogy sites, but it's only a set number per year. And they have to follow a very specific protocol of asking permissions and clarifying it's a certain type of crime and all of that. With this new world of genetic genealogy, there is no procedure yet. So police can use it in different ways. They don't have to necessarily go through any sort of process. Now that the databases have set certain kinds of crimes that it can be used for, but even that has changed again. So whereas GEDmatch did not permit it for burglary a few months ago, now they've added that those who have opted in for law enforcement searches are enabling law enforcement to use it for burglary. And some people feel quite differently about burglary and murder in terms of helping law enforcement arrest their relatives.
Let's bring in Scott now, joining us from Jefferson. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I don't think that information that people, like genetic information, I don't think it should be open for people to take for searches, for crimes or whatever. If you really sit and think about it, it could have almost like Orwellian implications. And none of it's guaranteed to, it scares me. I think that people should have the right to use these services just to be able to look up family information and maybe find out about like health issues or look up old family members without having to worry about their genetic information being taken for.
Have you done it personally, Scott? Have you looked at your family ancestry this way?
You know, I haven't, and the simple reason is because I have been afraid of what, you know, might happen to my information in the future.
Scott, thanks for the call. Will this perhaps impact people who want to use a registry like 23andMe? Could this even impact what those, you know, the number of people who are using sites like that?
I think at this point, it's impacting people in 23andMe in the sense that there are some people who are feeling more afraid. And they're actually, I've heard some reports that there has been that less people have been actually taking DNA tests and uploading to 23andMe and Ancestry in the last 6 months or so than they were before. Possibly, we don't know for sure, because people are starting to feel uncomfortable about some of that. That might also just be that it was moving at such a fast pace in the last year and then it slowed. But I think right now the primary impact on 23andMe and sites that are not being searched by law enforcement is that people are just feeling kind of uncomfortable because those sites are not working with law enforcement in the same way. But one thing that I have been told is that now, as law enforcement is getting more and more and more accustomed to working with these sites in cases where they're explicitly sanctioned to do so, or people have opted in to allow them to do so, or their privacy agreements allows them to do so, it's perhaps going to make them more eager to make more requests to use those other sites. And they'll have to go through some requests to do that, but it could increase the chances that they're going to try to do that.
Let's bring in Brian now from Heartland with thoughts on this. Brian, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So I've used 23andMe, actually. I've used both the ancestry and the health portion of it, and I was very pleased with it. But I also have an understanding that I'd like to hear the opinion of your guest on, and that it, when I submitted this genetic information, unfortunately, I think in the 21st...
Brian, are you there? Oh, I think he got cut up. I'm trying to figure out what he's trying to say there.
I know, I'm trying to figure out as well. I don't know. I mean, again, a concern a lot of people have is if they uploaded to 23andMe, is my DNA being used in these law enforcement searches? And the answer, again, is... It's not in the way that it's being used on these other sites. And it is important to be clear that on FamilyTreeDNA, everyone is opted in to be used for law enforcement, everyone in the United States. On GEDmatch, they've gone through different iterations, and you have to actively check a box and say, yes, you can use my stuff for law enforcement. Now, whether everyone is going to adhere to only using people who have opted in or who've said yes is something some people wonder about. But that is an important differentiation between how it works there and on 23andMe.
Let's bring in Robert in Oak Creek. Robert, hi.
Hi. I kind of want to correlate this to the Apple FBI issue that we had a few years ago, where Apple wouldn't let somebody onto their phone. I think that the genetic matching is probably less intimate. You're literally just looking at numbers and correlations between one person and another through data, and not even like intimate data, whereas in a phone there's pictures, there's phone calls, there's a whole lot of minute to minute data to collect, and I think that's far more intimate and far more scary to let just anybody have, especially considering that it's not just the owner of the phone, it's also the people that they're in contact with and who they've taken pictures of.
Robert, thanks. Heather, as we run short on time here, your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think the parallel to a phone is interesting. I think that phones in some ways are easier for us to wrap our minds around because we hold them in our hands, etc. But I think it's just worth considering as DNA continues to evolve, tiny bits of DNA can be, we leave them everywhere we go. So some people will say, okay, just like a phone in your hand, we leave a trail of DNA. Potentially in the future, as this continues to evolve, it's easy to therefore also see everywhere that somebody has been, as it's easier and easier to identify DNA. But it, agreed, it's more, it's a little bit more tangible to think about somebody breaking into a phone for a lot of people than to think about what it, this means with DNA.
Heather, thank you for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
Heather Tall Murphy is a reporter for the New York Times. Coming up, Wisconsin State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski is here to talk retirement savings, unclaimed property, student debt, so much more. Stay with us. News Update is next here on the Ideas Network. It's a conversation with the state treasurer here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Treasurer Sarah Godlewski took office 6 months ago, and we're checking in with her. In the past months, she's worked to expand the job that a referendum attempted to eliminate last year. And one of Treasurer Godlewski's first actions was requesting that the Legislative Reference Bureau provide a list of responsibilities that the treasurer is assigned to do by law. 17 things came up. What issues do you think the state treasurer should be working on? Do you want the treasurer to provide Wisconsinites perhaps more information about the finances of state government? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Treasurer Godlewski, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate, for having me. When you said it was 6 months, it's like, wow,
time flies.
Yeah, when you're having fun. Exactly.
Well, what's your reaction to the state budget that Governor Evers signed last week?
Well, in my mind, just looking at the last 6 months in the budget process, this is exactly what compromise looks like. When you go to the people and listen to what they're looking for, the legislature and the governor take that information. And then the governor, I think, did a great job of delivering what was an effective budget overall. I mean, if you look at it, there's really three things to me that kind of pop up. The first is, what was he funding? And the governor campaigned on he wants to make sure we fund public education. He wants to make sure we fund health. And he wants to make sure we fund transportation. And those were three things that he funded in this budget. I mean, we saw the highest increase in public education in over a decade. We saw the same in transportation, over $500 million. To do special projects. And then the same thing, I mean, I think healthcare was a little bit of a different challenge because of the whole Medicaid situation. So It was looking at not just what, but then how is that from a financially sound perspective? And that's what I was really worried about is, you know, we talk about all this spending and what does that look like? And when I looked at it from a fiscally responsible perspective.
I mean, this is $82 billion, right?
Right. This isn't just like pocket change laying around.
No. Right.
And really, what are our tax dollars going to? But is it an efficient way? And how does it overall look like? And to me, two things popped up. I think what I was impressed about is overall, he was able to decrease overall expenditures by almost $20 million. And what that means is that at the overall perspective of the budget, we are now more sound when it comes to like what is a structurally balanced budget. And when we talk about a structurally balanced budget, we're looking at revenue, expenses, and reserves. And is that the right mix? And this budget actually has been one of the most sound structurally that we've had in a really long time. And I think that's a great thing for taxpayers. So in addition to a sound structurally balanced budget, funding public education, healthcare, and roads, we also saw a tax cut for the middle class with income tax of over 10%. So to me, these were important things that were able to get done in 6 months. And I think that's exactly what Wisconsinites were looking for.
The governor had originally proposed to give your office about $500,000 in additional funding, but Republicans blocked that increase from happening. Where do you stand on that? How would your office use those additional funds?
So I think I will be honest, this has probably been one of the most frustrating things about my job is that I don't think it's about what can the value bring with regards to the treasurer's office. It has become much more about, is this a partisan issue? And the treasurer's office shouldn't be a partisan issue. I mean, a couple things to point out. One is we have over $12 million in our checking account, so we weren't going to be using tax dollars to fund this office. This office has been funded from the revenue in which we bring, and it's always been that way. And so when we were asking for $500,000, one of the things that we talked about is, look, we will provide taxpayers between $2 to $5 million in return to prove ourselves. We're willing to prove ourselves to taxpayers to say, look, like, we're willing to return property. We're willing to find money that has been probably misallocated or not well spent, exactly what a fiscal watchdog is doing. And we can guarantee almost a 200% return on your investment by just investing $500,000. And yet we still weren't able to get anywhere. Now, in business, if you gave somebody a 200% return on investment, they would say, that's a steal. We should do that. And so I think that's what's been so frustrating, is it has nothing to do about what we can bring taxpayers. It's become this partisan issue, and there's no need for that.
We are talking with State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski. What are your questions for her? What do you think the State Treasurer should be doing? What issues do you think the State Treasurer should be working on? And what do you want her to address as you look at retirement planning and student loan debt? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Chris now from Adams. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. You have been assigned by, you've been assigned by the governor to a three-person panel to set up and do this task force on student loan debt. And I'm in the middle of a student loan nightmare, and I'd like to know what the schedule is for the little townhouse meetings you're having with people, and then what you see as the focus of where that should go.
Chris, thanks. What about the Student Loan Refinancing Task Force?
So, first of all, Chris, thanks for pointing that out. I think one thing just to mention is that, unfortunately, the Student Loan Task Force was removed from the budget, and so it's no longer a part of that overall budget package. That being said, I recently had a great conversation with the governor's office, and we're going to move forward with that because we, as executives, have task force authority. And so the first really critical aspect of an effective task force with regards to student loan debt that we're going to be looking at is listening to what Wisconsinites are struggling with. So we plan, exactly to your point, Chris, traveling the state to really make sure that we understand the problems. My mom always jokes, you know, Sarah, you have two ears and one mouth for a reason, so you should do more listening as a politician and probably less talking. And I 100% agree with her on that. So we want to make sure we're understanding with regards to, are there key challenges with consumer protection? Are there key problems with financial solutions, with we need more tax incentives in Wisconsin for people handling student loan debt. So our first priority is listening. Now, we are in the process of setting up a website currently, and hopefully in the next couple of weeks we'll have that done. And Chris, you'll be able to see our schedule as we travel the state. And then from there, we will then start going into how are the solutions that we can best fit Wisconsinites in addressing this $24 billion problem.
So, yeah, you're going to gather up all this information around student loan debt in Wisconsin, and then you bring it together, and then you think, now, what do we do here? What are some possible things you can do to alleviate this problem?
So for me, I think it's a couple things. One is with consumer protection. I mean, we recently were in La Crosse, and one of the stories that we heard was about a woman who had a call, for example, with a private lender, and they said that they could reduce her rates by one percentage point. Now, what they didn't tell her is that she would lose all of her federal benefits if she refinanced with a private lender. And at the end of the day, she actually wasn't saving any money. And so they weren't being forthcoming and disclosing. What are the consequences if you refinance with a private lender? What could that look like? And further, it was a floating type rate, and so that increased exponentially after she signed up.
Oh, kind of like an arm?
Right.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
These are things that we want to make sure Wisconsinites are protected against with regards to making sure private lenders disclose information and provide transparency about their rates. I think the other critical area that we want to look at with refinancing is, who are we refinancing? Right now, we know refinancing is benefiting kids that are well off. are the whose parents are well off. In reality, we are looking at a lot of kids when they graduate from college do not have assets. They don't have collateral, and so they don't qualify for reasonable rates. So how can we make sure that we are providing them the quality lending that they need at a fair rate? I mean, we're in some of the lowest lending rates in the history, Kate, if you think about it. I mean, rates are like between, not to dork out, but anywhere between 1.5 to 3.5%. And yet we're charging students 15% on interest. This is insane. And I think it's unjust and something we have to address.
What do you want to see happen with child savings accounts?
So child savings accounts is a little bit of a different, I guess, bucket for me. And here's a couple of things that I want to see with child savings accounts. I think one is I'd like to see every kid in the state of Wisconsin get a child savings account at birth. But when it comes to that, I think the question is, I don't want it to just be for college. I think a lot of kids are looking at, they want to start a business, or they want to own a home, or they want to look at saving for retirement. So how can we open up a savings account that provides flexibility, but at the same time earns quality returns? So we know in a savings account right now, if you put in $100 and it has a 2% savings rate, you're not really making that much money by the time you're 18. But if you would invest it, for example, in like a Roth IRA, which is a retirement account, if we put $100 in for every kid that was born in the state of Wisconsin in a Roth, if they didn't touch it until they were 60, they would have over $200,000 by the time that they're 60. And we know in Wisconsin, one of the challenges facing many Wisconsinites is they're not able to save for retirement until they're 50. And so these are innovative ideas, I think, that we need to start talking about.
And you see a real crisis in retirement, people having enough in Wisconsin to retire on?
Right. Exactly. I mean, literally, the stat that came across my desk is that over 50% of Wisconsinites have less than $3,000 saved. Now, it's not because they don't care about retirement. One of the challenges is that 1 in 7 Wisconsin voters, they don't have access to it through their employer. And so,
like a 401k.
401k. It could be anything with regards to, there's a lot of different retirement tools that they could use. But yet, when you ask Wisconsinites, if you had a tool available, over 86% said that they would absolutely use it. And what we are finding is that when states provide tools, they are 15 times more likely to save. And so I think these are the things that we need to start talking about. I mean, Oregon has done a program, Kate, that I think has been the longest running. It's been now over 2 years. And literally within their 2 years, they had over 84,000 people join, 6,000 employers, and they created a fund of over $20 million. Now, people always ask me, Sarah, what's the cost for that? The cost is actually nothing, because we actually take some of the operational costs from the overall performance of the portfolio. So this is like a win-win for everybody. It's a win for Wisconsinites. It's a win because it doesn't actually cost taxpayers anything, but it helps make the state overall financially secure.
We're talking with State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski. What concerns do you have about the state's investments and its business dealings? How should the treasurer work for you? And how might we ease the burden of student loans, loan debt for Wisconsinites? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You have a line to the state treasurer, Sarah Godlewski, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's been 6 months since Democratic State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski was sworn into office alongside Governor Tony Evers and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes and Attorney General Josh Call. And since then, she's been working to expand the duties and the impact of her office that could have been eliminated in a statewide referendum in the spring of 2018. And she campaigned to keep the office and be the state's fiscal watchdog. So what questions do you have for the treasurer? What would you like her to address on the job? What duties do you think the office should oversee? Join in at 800-642-1234, and Treasurer Godlewski stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Mary Kay joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Good morning. I would like to bring up three different things. The first thing is a cap on interest rates for student loans. 35% is ridiculous. I mean, the state needs to put a cap on this interest rate. It's going to take people forever and ever to pay anything back. The second thing is, there is no such thing as free health care. Either you pay for your health care and you're not eligible, or you're eligible and you pay it back anyway. So there really is no such thing as free health care. Us taxpayers will be paying all the bills.
Oh, I'm sorry. And the third thing, Mary Kay, let's one more point. One more point. The laundry okay. list here. Yes.
The third one is Social Security, VA, people that are below poverty level shouldn't be paying taxes on that, because it shouldn't be taxable income, because that's their only income. They've been taxed on it when they earned it.
Thank you so much, Mary Kay. What can we tackle there?
So, first of all, Mary Kay, thanks for your questions. You're definitely making me work right now. I love it. One thing just to clarify is that our office has nothing to do with taxation. So that's what I think makes us such a good fiscal watchdog, because the legislature and the governor, they tax you. They figure out the tax rate. They then tell you how they're going to spend your money, and then they spend your money. We're really the office based on the constitutional framework to come in and say, did the government spend the money the way that they said they would? We're like an independent entity in that way. But with that being said, I think that, you know, with regards to interest rates, we absolutely agree. I mean, if you look at whether it's the housing market or other entities that are involved in lending, there's different caps on how much money they can make off of people. And when we're charging 15% interest on these students, I think we really have to look at, is that really fair with the risk involved? And so I think that's absolutely something that is part of the task force and something that we want to look at. With regards to healthcare, I mean, I agree. I don't think anything is free. What I have been really struggling with in this last budget is the fact that we did not take the Medicaid money. I mean, we are paying into that system, but yet New Jersey, Illinois, and California are getting the benefit of Wisconsinites that are paying into this tax system. And so if we would have taken that Medicaid money, that would have helped fund over 80,000 Wisconsinites. It would have provided over $300 million into the system. And then further, we would have got over $1.6 billion in new healthcare investments. And new healthcare investments make a big difference as far as generating jobs, generating to the economy here in Wisconsin. And so I think that's what's been really unfortunate. And so what do we do now to make sure we have a really effective and efficient healthcare system?
I want to touch on unclaimed property for a moment, because in 2013, the treasurer's job of running unclaimed property went to the revenue department. Is that still the case? Or,
yeah. So when they split the unclaimed property program, the way that they did it is that the Department of Revenue is responsible for processing the claims.
Okay.
And then what the treasurer is responsible for is making sure we reunite you with your rightful property. Now, one of the challenges has been, Kate, is that we haven't been funded for this responsibility in almost 4 years. So we recently did an analysis to say, okay, what is this cost on taxpayers for us actually not reuniting people with their rightful property? And we've found that since this office hasn't been funded to do that, taxpayers have been losing about $10 million a year, which has been over $40 million in 4 years. And so the government is keeping this property that doesn't belong to
them.
So
this property could be like a dormant bank account.
Yes.
It could be
a paycheck,
an insurance claim
that you forgot to pick up.
Okay.
Yeah, it can be almost anything. And so what's so important is that not only that we have a successful unclaimed property program, but you as Wisconsinites deserve your property. I mean, this was literally written into the Constitution because the founders believe that we shouldn't be holding property that doesn't belong to us. But yet we aren't able to get funding to make sure people are getting back the property that they deserve. I think the other important piece to mention is that the unclaimed property program does also help fund the Common School Fund, which is money that goes to public schools. And so by also not claiming unclaimed property from businesses that might have earned it. So to your point, I found when I was 16, I used to work at Pizza Hut in Eau Claire, Kate, and I found out. I know. I found out that I didn't pick up a check one time. And so that check then went into unclaimed property. That interest then helped provide money to public schools. But what was worse is I never knew that I even had that money. And that's what the treasurer was supposed to be doing, is letting people know that they can start taking their money.
Let's go to Steve in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, one of the great things that Governor Walker did with the Republicans a number of years back is enacting Act 10, which allows governments, local and state, to save quite a bit of money. One of the problems that I see, though, is that a lot of the people in power in those areas either lack the courage or don't know how to do it. One of the great things I would love to see the Treasury's Department do is have a task force that can go into these local governments or other places in state government and inform the public of ways that money could be saved, but those entities are just not doing it.
Steve, no, I think that's a really good question. And I want to really focus on the part about working with county and local governments. One of our statutory responsibilities is actually to work with county and municipal state treasurers. And that has not been done in a couple of years. And so we recently have developed a partnership with both the County Treasurers Association and the Municipal Treasurers Association. And one of the things that we have been talking to them about is how can we be a resource with regards to being more effective with investment dollars or being more effective with internal controls. And so those are things that we are looking at because we know money in local government is so scarce, but as a result, so important in helping communities achieve those projects. And so that is something that we are working on, is building that relationship so we can provide those kind of services to local government.
Have you faced any barriers or challenges in trying to build these deeper understandings of state finances and local government relations? Are state agencies reaching out to you and making those connections?
So we have been, when we got into office, one of the things that we did is first and foremost, we set up meetings with all the legislators to let them know kind of our goals and priorities. And the same thing was with state agencies. So meeting with agency heads and letting them know kind of that we are here, we want to be a part of the work. I mean, one of the responsibilities that was captured in statutes when we asked the Legislative Reference Bureau was that we should be working in collaboration with the Department of Administration and the Department of Revenue and how we manage funds and how we invest this money. And so that has been something that we have been working on and kind of figuring out what does that relationship look like.
So here we are halfway through your first year. Do you see any change in the attitudes that would allow for restoring some of your office's duties?
So to me, I think one of the biggest changes have been the people of Wisconsin. I mean, we literally get hundreds of calls in our office about people looking at talking about retirement or asking for help about student loan debt, or even, I mean, were calling us about the whole hemp industry. You know, the hemp industry was made a completely legal industry with the Farm Act. They considered hemp just like any other crop, like corn or wheat, Kate. But yet, some of the hemp businesses in Wisconsin were unable to get financing. And so they were calling us to say, can you help work with local financial institutions because we are doing everything right? And so I think what has been one of the biggest changes is people now see us as a resource, as an advocate for them financially. And that's something that we're going to continue to fight for and build our overall competency for Wisconsinites.
Really quickly, last few seconds, an annual report for Wisconsin, is that something that is on your agenda?
Yes. So one thing that I was shocked about as somebody who came from the private sector is, you know, when you sit on the board, whether it's for a company or for a nonprofit, you have an annual report. So your stakeholders or your donors for your nonprofit know how you're performing, what are they getting for their money. And when I came to state government, I was like, where's your annual report? I mean, we have what's called a CAFR. It's this comprehensive financial report. And that's like reading a 1,000-page just dictionary. And so we hope to put together this taxpayer annual report so people can see the transparency and what their tax dollars go toward.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate. It's always great to be here.
Treasurer Sarah Godlewski. Just ahead, two Wisconsin homes built by Frank Lloyd Wright have been made the UNESCO World Heritage List. We'll find out more. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.